Okay. Well, apologies for the use of technology in what is supposed to be a Blackboard talk. I will actually go to the Blackboard as well. But I want to show at least some pictures, and I think that's best done, at least easiest done for me with the computer. What I'd like to do is try and give you some sense of what has been, maybe this is a somewhat biased perspective on it, but what has been an exciting subfield at the interface between polymer physics and cell biology. And this, well, you may have thought that humans invented polymers, but in fact, nature beat us to that. And in fact, we have lots of them. And what eukaryotic or plant and animal cells actually are full of them in some sense, both for structural reasons and for things like cell motility. So I'll give you some idea of where these biopolymers are in most cases that we're going to be interested in, filamentous proteins, come from. And then I'll try and give you a brief outline of some of the sorts of questions that people at this program are interested in. One unifying theme or problem has been understanding the rheology or flow properties of these systems. And this comes in part from some nice experiments of Paul and others over the years looking at the rheological properties of these filaments reconstituted in vitro. Toward the end, I'll turn, if there's time, to somewhat more speculative and really exciting area going on right now, looking at some of the more biological aspects of these networks in the cellular context, namely what happens when you consider motor proteins and other active elements in the networks. Most of what I'll do is go through a problem that is incredibly simple to state, but I hope we'll show you that this problem can this area of semi-flexible and biopolymers illustrates or has a lot of rich behavior that I don't think one would expect, certainly from the from looking at the conventional polymer analogs. So I'll go through a simple toy problem, I'll call it, just to illustrate the dynamics of a single filament and make some connections with the rheology, bulk rheology of systems in so doing. So let me begin at what is probably the first biopolymer that comes to mind, namely DNA. This doesn't play a structural role as the ones that I will be focusing on, but it has been studied as a sort of as you would with synthetic polymers in some cases. Biologically, of course, the role of DNA is for carrying information, and this picture just illustrates that. On the scale of a few nanometers, tens of nanometers, indeed one can have a rather flexible chain. From the point of view of polymer physics, one nice thing about DNA and some of these other systems is that you have a great degree of control through biochemistry over length distributions, molecular weight, if you like, and other aspects, especially in the case of DNA. And of course, the chains can be extremely long, macroscopic in length. I want to focus mostly on what are what can be called filamentous proteins, and these play largely structural role in, say, eukaryotic cells. And in fact, these are filaments which have a double helical structure. This cartoon is meant to illustrate that. But each monomer making up this filament, in contrast with conventional polymer systems, where I have some small chemical, some small low molecular weight monomer, each monomer here is itself a rather high molecular weight globular protein. And these assemble to form a filament. That assembly is actually a rather dynamic process. In fact, it turns out they tend to grow from one end and shrink from another. These are polar filaments, it turns out. But a lot has been done to look at the flow properties of these things reconstituted in vitro solutions. Let me just show you a little bit first, though, why these or where these sorts of filaments come from in the cell. I'll get some colored chalk here. So just beginning with a sort of naive physicist picture of a cell, one of the things, of course, that distinguishes a plant or animal cell, I'll draw some not so symmetric blob here. One of the things that distinguishes plant or animal cells from prokaryotes or bacteria is, of course, the presence of a nucleus. And it turns out one of the other main distinguishing features is the presence of a lot of structural, primarily, not only, but at least at first sight, structural filaments. For instance, I was going to color these. Microtubules. Which one of the roles of these microtubules, which are rather rigid filaments that can actually span the whole cell. The scale here, of course, is of order tens of microns, perhaps 100 microns. These microtubules are very rigid elements that, in part, organize the cell, hold organelles in place. So in addition to the nucleus, you have various other possibly held in place by microtubules, various other organelles. So this is one of the filamentous proteins that's been studied quite a bit in detail. And in addition to this sort of structural aspect of microtubules, as many of you know, they're used also for active transport of material within cells. So these are actually also polar, sort of railways, if you like, and motor proteins can move cargo around in the cell. It turns out the polymerization of these things also generates forces. And those forces play a role in, for instance, in cell division when you separate chromosomes. And just by polymerization alone, you can get, in fact, motors also probably play a role, but polymerization alone can give you forces. The system I just showed a moment ago, namely filamentous actin, occurs, well, this is one of the main places it occurs. I don't mean to indicate this is the only place it occurs. But it tends to form a network, which I'll just sort of sketch in this way, typically near the periphery of a cell, and is largely responsible for the elastic response of cells to external stresses and so forth. Naively, it looks a lot like a sort of rubber network. And in fact, one can think of it in part as a sort of elastic network. It turns out also to be quite dynamic, of course. These filaments are polymerizing and depolymerizing all the time, and there's motors that also act on these filaments as well. This is known as F-actin. And in addition to these two main filaments, microtubules and actin, which are actually very well conserved from species to species and even different cell types within one, there's a lot of other more specialized filaments, so-called intermediate filaments, say IF here for intermediate filaments, which, for instance, can connect one cell to the next cell, can also be associated with the organelles within the cell. These tend to be much more specialized, and there's a greater variety of these. As you may know, actin also plays a role in our muscle. It's one of the two main fibers that is responsible for contractile motion in muscles. And in fact, that's where one typically obtains actin that's then studied in a test tube or rheometer. Okay, so briefly, that's just meant to show you some of the origin of these filaments. This picture here at the bottom shows in greater detail what this network can look like near the periphery of cells. I don't have a scale bar here, but the full length horizontally would be about a micron. And this gives you some sense of the density of these filaments. Their spacing is of order 100 nanometers or less. So those sorts of networks have motivated a number of studies in vitro. And one sort of trivial reason, I don't mean to trivialize the work involved in this, but only that only to say it's a very obvious reason why one might be interested in these things from a polymer point of view. It's as if you scale everything up from the conventional polymer world up into the micron range. And so you can actually begin to see some basic aspects of polymer physics, say dynamics, in a light microscope. And this is a picture actually from that time Paul Janmi's group by Josef Kays, which just illustrates what a network would look like if you label a very small fraction of filaments fluorescently. So only a few of the filaments are shown here. You should imagine something more like this network with only the occasional one showing in that that image. So there's a lot of surrounding filaments constraining each one of these in its motion, lateral motion. But this begins to show you in a real picture the scale of these things. They can be many microns long, and even in the presence of thermal fluctuations or Brownian motion, they would appear of order they would appear to be straight on the scale of perhaps 10 microns.
How do you build single filaments?
Paul would be better person to explain that, but you introduce a fraction of fluorescently labeled groups on the side of this. Is that correct?
The easiest thing to do is make a very dilute solution of fluorescently labeled filaments and then stop their polymerization and then polymerize around them occasionally on the label you have.
Oh, yeah. In other words, how you get a small fraction of them, right? So most of what we aren't seeing here are actually other filaments that would form constraints for the few labeled ones that you can see. As I said, that's one obvious reason why you might be interested in these sorts of systems. Biopolymers are not just limited to those that I tried to sketch there in the cell. Another active area, particularly from the point of view of studying the liquid crystalline phases that you can get with these, has been various studies of viruses, some of which are linear objects. So this picture here is actually so-called FD virus from Jay Tang. We saw this actually in a talk of his a few days ago. What you actually have here is a thin tube, a thin filament, rather uniformly about a micron in length, which is just polymer coating DNA. Protein coating DNA. The dimensions are very similar to what I showed you before. It's about 7 nanometers in width and just shy of a micron in length. And as I said, these have been studied in part to look for liquid crystalline phases that form. Before I get into that, let me just point out one of the main characteristics that you need to bear in mind in thinking of these systems, especially if you come from think of these from the sort of more conventional polymer side. They're semi-flexible filaments, or actually rather rigid filaments on any conventional polymer scale. And we can characterize that by a bending energy with some material constant telling us how rigid and detailed they are to bending. And then just an integral of the curvature squared down the length of the filament would give us a rather accurate description of the bending energy, provided that I don't introduce very tight bends into the structure. And in fact, actin will bend on the scale of microns or so.
So is theta related to like dr by dF?
So theta is actually the local tangent, and the derivative of that, the gradient of that along the filament, gives me a measure of curvature. I'll show another, maybe more familiar expression for curvature in a moment as a second derivative of a spatial coordinate.
Third order thing, or
it's second order. So in other words, it's not a signed quantity. If I have a gradient this way, it should cost me the same as a gradient that way. And it's harmonic in the curvature, local curvature. If you do this and look at the what happens at finite temperature, or if you like, if you look at the consequences of Brownian motion that this filament is subject to in solution, you find that the these tangent vectors or angles along the filament are correlated, but in a manner that shows that you actually get a decay of correlations. It's exponential, actually, from one point of the filament to another. And that introduces a length scale, persistence length, which just comes from this material constant and temperature. Obviously, the persistence length goes down with temperature. The greater the thermal fluctuations, the more it'll tend to curve around. And this is a key thing that I'll keep referring to, known as the persistence length. And for actin, for this filament I've tried to show here, that persistence length is measured to be about 17 microns. So it's indeed of order many microns on the scale as that previous picture showed. A naive estimate based on essentially elasticity theory you can look up in Landau and Lifshitz for rods. A naive description of this bending constant here would show you that that it increases as the fourth power of the diameter or radius of the filament, together with a material constant, the Young's modulus for that material. So this is treating it as a homogeneous elastic rod. Turns out to be not a bad description if you just look at the numbers. If you just take a Young's modulus for a typical hard material, like 10 to the 9 pascals, and look at the radius of actin filaments, which is about 3 nanometers, you'd get about 10 microns for a persistence length, which is not too far from what you see. By comparison, if you go to these stiffer filaments, microtubules, they're about 3 times the diameter, and that means about 100 times as stiff. Surprisingly, those things, those microtubules here, are only 20 nanometers in width. Turns out they're actually tubes, they're not homogeneous rods. But they're about 20 nanometers in width, but if you could look at them on the scale of micron, in fact, excuse me, at the scale of millimeter, and in fact you can grow them rather long, they would actually appear straight even in the presence of thermal fluctuations on that scale. Basically, what the thing to note here is that the stiffness increases at a very high power of the radius, and this is the basic characteristic of all these biopolymers being essentially bulkier systems. What you could call the aspect ratio, the ratio of the persistence length to the molecular dimension, say the diameter, this grows as the third power of that diameter. And so that aspect ratio increases very rapidly as you go to these bulky biopolymer systems. Even if you go down to DNA, which is still rather large on the scale of conventional polymer systems, it has a diameter of about 20 angstroms, you'd estimate, it turns out to be a little overestimate, of about 100 nanometers for the persistence length. DNA would be straight on the scale of about 500 angstroms. Okay, so this is basic characteristic of these systems. I want to briefly tell you some of the reasons why people are interested in biopolymers from even a conventional polymer background, let alone some of the more biological aspects that I'll maybe get to at the end. One of the first things that to note about these systems is they do indeed form liquid crystalline phases. And one thing people have been interested in has been the fact that they actually exhibit new phases that have not been previously observed in other conventional systems. I'll show one of these in a moment. I don't want to dwell a lot on liquid crystalline aspects, but it is one of the main reasons people have been interested in it. As I said before, rheology, or the flow properties of these biopolymers, has been sort of a main common reason why a number of us, at least at this program, have been interested in them. And this includes some of the new experimental techniques that have been developed to study these. So-called microrheology is one of these. We'll hear more about this in Christoph's talk tomorrow. The idea is to try and measure these rheological or flow properties down at the micron scale, because you'd like to actually be able to characterize living cells, for instance. Or, for other very basic reasons, look at rheology at a small scale. I want to spend time going over this point here, having to do with the dynamics of a single filament, because it's a relatively simple calculation that I can take you through, and it'll illustrate a rather rich dynamical behavior. Another thing we've heard about, though, at this workshop has to do with some of the geometric aspects of twist and writhe, for instance, of these filaments. They are indeed relatively classical elastic rods, and the relationship between twisting and, well, what I can't do to this thing, writhing of the filament is something a number of people have been interested in. And we've heard a couple of talks by Tony Maggs and Chris Wiggins about this. Tony, for instance, pointed out an interesting analogy with Berry's phase, if you look at the twist and writhe of these filaments. As I said, if there's time, I'll get to some of the active aspects. Let me very briefly go over why you should have a liquid crystalline phase of first of all, rigid rods. Let me just look at the interaction between two filaments, two rigid rods in solution. And without any loss of generality, I'll take one of them to be vertical. And let me ask the following question. Given the presence of this rod here, how much of the volume is excluded for another one at some arbitrary angle? There's an angular dependence, of course, to this, but I don't want to get into that. So let me take something which is perpendicular. Obviously, if I have no long-range interaction between these things, this rod here doesn't know anything about the presence of this one until they lie in the same plane, or actually what I mean to say is that when they lie in a slab given by their width, they lie in a common slab. And then in that plane, if you like, in which they sit, the constraints on this one, due to the presence of this one, correspond to a volume. There's a region that I can't explore simply because of the presence of this this first filament. So, for instance, if I look at the centers, the region available to the centers of this second filament, it's excluded from a region its length divided by 2 to the side here and likewise over here. So I get an excluded volume which goes as L squared, where L is the length of this thing, times the width of one of these. Now, that's the excluded volume that this one cannot explore due to the presence of this other one. Of course, it occupies a real volume. This filament here occupies a real volume, which is given by A squared times L. So the ratio of those gives me a volume fraction, which goes like A over L. Again, this aspect ratio. Oops, sorry. In this case, the length to the diameter of the filament. And so that tells me if I exceed this volume fraction, they'll start to feel each other, and in fact, they start to align. That's the essence of an argument going back to Onsager, which can actually be generalized to the case of semi-flexible filaments, where it is, in fact, this aspect ratio of the molecular dimension to the persistence length that enters. And so, for instance, in the case of actin, where that aspect ratio is about 1,000, at volume fractions of order 0.1%, you already start to develop a pneumatic phase. And this is observed. There's a variety of exotic liquid crystalline phases you can look at. This is a picture taken from Seth Fraden's group at Brandeis. They actually took this FD virus I showed before and put it in solution with a bunch of balls, if you like. So you have rods and balls. The balls actually are, I don't actually recall whether they were polystyrene spheres, but they may have been. At the scale of about a micron or less. And what you see is spontaneously the formation of layered structures where the rods form layered sheets, because they're still free to move around a lot in that plane. And then the balls are excluded also to planes and even formation, they even form columns. And the amusing aspect of this is all of this order comes about simply because of this excluded volume interaction that I mentioned. So if you like, out of entropy, the volume available for each particle in the system, we get order. So that's certainly amusing. It's just one of the liquid crystalline phases, as I said, that you can look at. In another extreme, if you go down to lower concentrations, though, we could ask another question, which is, at what concentration do I have to go so that the filaments are so far apart that they take on a completely random coil configuration between entanglement points or contact points between filaments and would therefore begin to behave just as conventional flexible polymer systems? A naive estimate of that shows that that volume fraction goes like this inverse square of that aspect ratio. And so what you have, at least the possibility, is that you could have an isotropic phase separated by these two concentrations, above which you have a pneumatic and below which you have conventional flexible polymer behavior. And this window of concentration, actually the size of that is directly related to this aspect ratio. So in the case of actin, where you have about three orders of magnitude separating the molecular dimension and the persistence length, you have potentially several orders of magnitude in concentration over which something different from flexible behavior and yet not pneumatic should occur. And that's the essence of why at least a number of people have been interested in understanding the rheology of that regime. It's qualitatively new from the point of view of conventional polymer systems. Let me very briefly tell you a little bit about viscoelasticity in these and actually in conventional systems. If you imagine taking a bulk sample of polymeric material, whether cross-linked or not, and you imagine shearing it, actually specifically applying a stress to the surface and trying to deform the system as I've shown here, what will happen typically is it'll deform in some maybe rapid deformation here, followed by what's referred to as a plateau, where the deformation is nearly constant. And in fact, that's what you'd have for an elastic material such as rubber, where you have cross links. And indeed, that deformation will store elastic energy, which you could recover. If I don't have cross links, but rather have a solution, at long times, the filaments, which might actually be in some mess like this, can slowly disentangle by thermal fluctuations. It's actually a Brownian motion along their contours and essentially reptation, and ultimately the system will flow at long times. Equivalently, we could look at this picture by basically reversing both axes, looking not at the deformation but the resistance to deformation, and looking not at time but frequency. And this is actually a more familiar way to plot a rheology, at least for some people. Down here at low frequency, I have that long time regime I just mentioned of disentanglement. At intermediate times, I have an elastic-like response coming from the fact that the filaments are in some way or other entangled. The nature of that entanglement in these semi-flexible systems is a very subtle question that has been sorted out only over the last few years. I don't really want to get into that. Instead, I want to turn to a simpler problem because we can actually calculate something. Namely, what happens as you go to high frequencies, this short time regime, if you like. Here, because as you go to higher frequencies, you effectively probe shorter wavelength relaxations of the system, at some point I begin to see directly single filament behavior. And it's this regime here which is directly related to this toy problem I want to go through. There's been some nice experiments on this. First, in the case of actin, at least interpreted in terms of rheology, were actually came from Christoph Schmidt's group back in the 97. I'll describe a little bit more about the theoretical origin of this, of course, in a moment. But this observation of characteristic observation of the frequency dependence of the shear modulus, which actually increases with an exponent of 3/4, it turns out, has been reported in a number of experiments. The experts know that I'm glossing over some subtleties. It's not so easy to interpret some of those experiments, and the jury is out to some extent. But this sort of behavior has been observed in the rheology. And let me show you how one can begin to understand that from a single filament point of view. So I want to begin with a toy problem. Where, for simplicity, I'm going to imagine attaching rigidly a filament to one point. And I want to look at the motion, fluctuations, and actually response of that filament if I pull on the end. So let me say it has a full contour length, if I were to fully stretch it, of L. But of course, it contracts a little bit due to its transverse thermal fluctuations. And I'll call that amount delta L. I'm implying a constraint here of fixed contour length. In other words, L equals the integral of ds. Of course, I could relate ds to the square root of 1 plus the gradient of the displacement field of this along some coordinate x. And I'll approximate that 1 plus square root term this way. So that'll tell me the length of the filament, which is assumed to be rigidly constrained. In other words, the integral of this quantity tells me about that relaxation of the end. Okay, I want to look at the way in which this quantity fluctuates over time, the dynamics of the motion of this endpoint. Let me begin, though, by looking at a static problem. Because we can already begin to learn something about the rheology of these systems. We look at a static problem. I want to look at what happens if I pull on the end of this with some tension tau. I want to see the response of the filament to that tension. So let me go back to the description of the bending energy of this filament, but now in terms of this field, U, I'll integrate two derivatives now of U with respect to x squared. That'll be the curvature. These two variables are conjugate. When I pull on it, I change this displacement. So that actually means the corresponding term in the energy is this. And from this, we can determine the response of this endpoint to the applied tension. So just do that briefly here. I'm first of all going to re-express this in terms of a Fourier expansion of this. So I have a sum over a bunch of modes q, kappa q to the fourth from these two derivatives squared. And then the square of those amplitudes. And then equipartition will just tell me I have harmonic terms in the energy, independent degrees of freedom, so I can tell right away what these amplitudes are. And in fact, even up to factors of 2, I think, although pretty soon I'll start losing factors of 2 in pi, probably, I get this. So now what we can do is go back and calculate this displacement and look at how it depends on the tension and get a linear response and actually the corresponding response function for the filament. Actually, let me go ahead and rewrite this then, likewise, as a sum over modes, looks like that. And then in thermal equilibrium, I could look at the response of this thing to an applied tension. And well, to save time, let me write down the result. I'll call it alpha naught, the response function, just relating the tension to the deformation. As I've written things, it's actually minus the derivative of dl with respect to tau. So I have to sum up over these modes here in this term. I'll turn that into an integral, and the integral looks like this. And the important thing to note here is this integral, everything's coming from the low end of this integral, small q, long wavelength. Physically, that's just saying that because of this very strong dependence of the energy on q, everything's dominated by low q. And that cutoff, of course, goes inversely with the length of the filament. And so we get this response function. It's kT over kappa squared and goes to the fourth power of the length. There's one thing we can already see from this picture, though, in terms of the rheology. If I were to look at the inverse of this response function, the response function tells me the compliance of the system. The inverse of it will tell me a shear modulus, actually. So G, which goes as the inverse of alpha. Actually, as I pull on the filament, the response function goes down, or in other words, the tension goes up more than you'd expect for a linear spring. I actually get a nonlinear response diverging at the point where I pull out all the thermal fluctuations. So this nonlinear response is actually something that, well, not necessarily this response quantitatively. What I mean to say is qualitatively, the rheological experiments on these biopolymer systems do characteristically show strain hardening. So this increase of the shear modulus corresponds to strain hardening. And at least qualitatively, one can begin to understand that from this simple picture, if I have a cross-linked network.
Excuse me, you said, what about entropic effects?
This is all entropic, in the sense that what I'm looking at are these thermally excited transverse modes. That's wherever kT enters, if you like, that's expressing that fact. Those modes depend, obviously, on the temperature. So you could say it's fully entropic effect, together with, of course, this constraint, this which is crucial to keep in mind. That's where the nonlinearity actually comes from.
and also you're assuming it's really strange.
Yeah, there's various things that I've done here. I'm looking at it. Sure. So this is a description valid for this quantity less than the persistence length, if you like. Okay, the main reason I wanted to do this, though, was to relate. I said I wanted to tell you about the dynamics of these filaments. And we can actually understand those results from this one calculation that we need to do. So let me show you how that works. So basically, I want to just do a dynamic version of this right now. One more thing. This is the response function. Equivalent, of course, to this would be looking at just the magnitude of the thermal fluctuations, the variance of this position here. So equivalently, I'll call it delta L squared, is just, it's really just this times KT. And if you remember how KT was related to, how KT related the persistence length and this bending constant, I actually get a simple scaling result, at least, where the mean square fluctuations of the end grow as L to the fourth and decrease with persistence length squared. Okay. The dynamics of these systems, these filaments, are controlled by the relaxation of these transverse modes in the solvent, though. That is obviously left out so far from this picture. So we can look at that. Let's look at the dynamics. Let's look at the force per length on this filament as it moves laterally. Well, I'll first of all have a term which I can get by a variational derivative of the energy with respect to the displacement at some point. I also have a drag coefficient, zeta, times u dot, the velocity of the transverse velocity of the filament at that point. And then, of course, I have stochastic terms. And if I now just ask the question, how the filament will relax, how a given wavelength will relax if I put in a bend on it, I can actually more or less read that off from this here. Notice that for, one thing to note here, this drag coefficient per unit length is actually obviously directly related to the viscosity of the solvent up to logarithmic terms that I don't want to get into having to do with basically 2D hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics in the two transverse dimensions that I have here. What you can calculate is the rate of relaxation of a mode of wavelength q, or wave vector q, and I can get that just by comparing these two terms. The variational derivative of the energy, which involves the square of curvature of the filament, will give me 4 powers of q. Because after I do integration by parts, what I find actually is that the relaxation goes like this. The relaxation rate grows as q to the fourth. Obviously, depends on how stiff the filament is, and is slowed down by the hydrodynamic drag. This is all low Reynolds number, of course. Quite valid for these the relevant essentially because we're looking at the micron scale, provided that the frequencies are not too large. So this relaxation rate tells me something about the typical wavelength of transverse undulations that relax in a given time. So at for times, write it this way. where time t, or up to time t, only modes of wavelength now less than some maximum, which I can get a length scale from here at a given time, which is over drag coefficient. The corresponding length goes as the 1/4 power of time. And only modes with wavelength less than this can relax. And I'll call this length little l perp of t. It tells me the typical wavelength of transverse undulations that can relax on a given time. That'll allow us to generalize this to a frequency dependence or time dependence. So if I want to know now the time-dependent response when I pull on the end of this, different sections of length L perp here behave effectively independently of each other. There are L over L perp of those sections. Each one of those has an amplitude given by this, where I replace L by L perp. And that should give me I have calculated not the response function, but the mean square displacement of the end. And the point is that this now grows as the third power of L perp, which is proportional to t to the 3/4. And if I translate that into a response function, and actually look at the frequency-dependent response function, not the time-dependent one, I actually get a frequency dependence with the same power, but an inverse. And again, if you take my word for the fact that you can relate that response function, actually the inverse of it, to the bulk rheology of a sample, that means that I should have a 3/4 exponent relating the shear modulus and the frequency.
Let me just understand what that means. You're using the damping to get rid of certain modes. Fluctuation, you can also turn that around, right? And give me the amplitude, the typical L perp just from fluctuation dissipation. There was something exciting from the interaction with the.
Yeah, what I actually.
I guess I'm saying is that the F stochastic.
Basically, if you leave this out, you will find, and you just do a deterministic problem, look at the relaxation of a bending mode. It relaxes exponentially. Basically because it's an overdamped system, and this would be the typical rate. That's also the typical frequency, if you like, or rate, corresponding to the thermal fluctuation, how the thermal fluctuations of a given wavelength are decorrelated, actually. So you could relate that to a correlation, to a time and a correlation function.
Can I ask you something? How seriously do people take these exponents, 3/4, and can experiment distinguish between, say, 3/4 and 1 and 3/5?
Oh,
everything is plausible, right? But there's always some question. Everything is plausible. The lower cutoff would be slightly different. You could change the power. So it's very accurate.
So here's an example of the experiments. You see over many decades. What clearly can be distinguished from an exponent of 1. Now, the physics behind these experiments, I don't actually want to get into. It's very interesting, but it actually is the subject of another talk. What's actually done for these experiments? This is actually from Christoph's lab. We'll see more about this actually tomorrow, presumably. What's actually done is to monitor the displacement, thermal displacement of a small micron-sized bead in solution, with certain caveats that is indeed directly related to the rheology of the system, if you were to measure it in bulk. It turns out you cannot measure this in bulk rheometers. The frequency is such that you just couldn't reach reach that limit. We're talking about up to kilohertz here. But these data clearly can be distinguished from an exponent of one.
What are the different G's that you have?
Yeah, the other thing I didn't go into is the fact that when I drew a simple shear modulus before, it actually has two, if I talk about the frequency-dependent shear modulus, it has two parts, an in-phase part and an out-of-phase part, roughly telling me about the viscous portion and the elastic portion. Anyway, those are the experiments that exist so far. A variety of other experiments, including from light scattering, that we may also hear about, have shown that exponent as well, over a wider frequency. Now, for the experts, I'm glossing over some subtleties here. Tony's probably squirming. But what I really wanted to do is show you in the single filament problem how rich the dynamics of that simple problem can be. And so the one last thing I want to do is show you corrections to this picture. And let me begin by showing essentially a contradiction and then go back and clean up the problem. If we just look at this result right here, the dynamics of the fluctuating end of a filament, this is well borne out by simulations. I'll show some of those simulations in a moment, over at least a certain time window. What I've assumed in doing this calculation is that the tension was uniformly distributed over this filament. That's a bad assumption if I do the naive experiment of, at time zero, pulling on the end with a given tension. That tension actually propagates down the filament in a way that can be calculated. And this is something that the two people in that corner of the room showed, Tony and Ralph, at least in terms of this response function or displacement. The tension propagation issue was something alluded to before in Dave Morse's theory as well. Let's look at the implications of this response function here. So let me look at the drag on the filament. If I pull on the end, and if it moves as I've just described, the whole filament moves in response. I get a drag which is proportional to the length of the filament, the drag coefficient per unit length, and delta L dot, the time derivative of this displacement. This is something I can relate to the response function. It's almost that. So I get L zeta. That's actually that. I now need to take the time derivative of this quantity, and if you'll allow me to throw away factors like 3/4, it's equivalent to just dividing that term by t. I'm only going to give you a scaling result here. So this tells me about the drag coefficient, the total drag on the filament, and leaving out one term. Obviously, the response function times the tension tells me about the motion. So here's the velocity of the end, what that translates to in drag for the whole filament. But the problem is, notice how this increases with the length of the filament. That's unphysical in the sense that this had better be no greater than the force that I pull on the end with. And that translates to an inequality. L can be no longer than, well, K kappa here times time divided by that drag coefficient was, at least apart from a fourth root, that was the this length L perp. So in fact, what I have here is the following inequality. The length can't be any longer than the geometric mean of the persistence length and this characteristic length or wavelength of modes that can relax up to a given time. That goes as t to the 1/4. This goes as t to the 1/8. Now, oddly enough, for this problem, t to the 1/8 is actually faster than t to the 1/4, as I'll show you. In other words, we're interested in short times, so this is more singular than t to the 1/4. Basically, at longer times, the tension can indeed propagate the full length of the filament. So if I now go back to this result here, the mistake I made was putting in the full length of the filament here, at least at short times. It's valid over a certain time window. I'll call this length L parallel of T. It tells me the distance over which the tension can propagate in a given time. And so that actually means that if I were to look at the motion of the endpoint as a function of time, actually the variance of that, that would, well, when I plug in this L parallel here, it goes from t to the 3/4 to t to the 7/8. And admittedly, here's where this, you begin to see the zoo of exponents, but they're real and observable in experiments, as I'll show you. This, for subtle reasons I don't want to go into, doesn't directly relate to the rheology in the way that I just showed you. Basically, we're looking at a toy problem here of a fluctuating filament and a quiescent solvent rather than shearing a solution of filaments. But what I hope this shows is that from a relatively simple problem to state, we see at least a couple of distinguishable and unexpected from the point of view of conventional polymer systems, certainly, dynamical regimes. And this last effect has to do with this tension propagation that I mentioned. If we were to look at the consequences of this for a finite segment of the filament, I wrote down two lengths. The first of these is down here. That's the length scale over which transverse bending undulations relax, or the characteristic dynamics of those. So that grows as t to the 1/4. This length here tells me about how the tension propagates. Those two lengths, at least in the scaling sense, are equal at the persistence length. So I plotted lengths here on the vertical axis and time on the horizontal axis. And then if I'm looking at a particular filament, as I said before, whose total length is less than the persistence length of the filament, that would correspond to some value over here on the right, what we have is a short time regime over which the tension has not propagated the full length of the filament. There the dynamics is described by what I mentioned, t to the 7/8. After that point, when the tension has propagated the full length of the filament, I get t to the 3/4. So the first thing I calculated is that shaded regime. And as I said, the point of this is to just go through an actual calculation that shows just one of the simpler results, at least to state, how these systems both differ from conventional polymer systems and actually are rather rich. I will, in view of time, not go into, well, here's the simulations that show this 7/8. I won't go into some of the more, I think, more active areas, so to speak, for future work. There's a lot of interest in going beyond these sorts of polymer physics descriptions, namely of the response of a passive network of these, and really start looking at the consequences of molecular motors. We began to hear a little bit about that in Tani's talk earlier, looking at, for instance, relaxation mechanisms that occur if you have active transportive filaments. And I'm particularly interested in other issues such as force generation and transmission, and ultimately how cells can begin to sense forces and how the networks respond to forces. The basic one basic thing to keep in mind here, again, qualitatively different from polymer systems, and a thing that hasn't really been explored very well. The approach to continuum elasticity in these systems is very different from conventional polymer systems, where you could imagine sort of continuum elastic description almost down to the typical scaling separating filaments. Here I have another length scale, namely the persistence length, and these rigid filaments can actually transmit forces in a way very different from continuum elasticity, and the crossover to continuum elasticity I think is a very interesting problem. Anyway, with that, I'll close.
Mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand why you'd expect the same drag term for motions transverse as opposed to the motion of the whole thing.
Naively, they differ by a factor of two. The longitudinal drag coefficient is different from the transverse drag coefficient at low Reynolds number for a rigid rod.
Yeah, but also I was thinking more that it's not really such. Maybe I've got the wrong picture, but my picture isn't a rigid rod. It's a picture of a fluctuating rigid rod, and the amplitude of the fluctuations are so small compared to the size that it doesn't change the dimension of.
Yeah, what one should really do is, of course, the only thing I really described was everything in terms of this transverse coordinate. But what you really need to do is take into account the two distinguishable motions, essentially longitudinal and transverse. And if you do that, you could you guys have done this, for instance. You get more than just a scaling result, which I indicated here. But it does. Sorry?
The coefficient comes from pure hydrodynamics. You take into account the
and low Reynolds number.
And then turn out the scale the same way.
I have a question. So we think of these oscillations as isothermal or adiabatic?
Isothermal. Everything is sitting in I have an isolated filament sitting in a thermal bath. Another point that really should be made here is T, the temperature, is not really a control parameter as you normally would think in a lot of more conventional material systems. Here, everything is so sensitive to temperature, you can't actually vary it, for instance, and look for temperature dependences. I know it's not the point of your question, but it's just something I forgot to mention. But isothermal is I think, the appropriate way to look at it.
In the frequency range that you consider, is there enough time to establish
the thermal condition? So you're interested in the thermal diffusion, let's say, down the filament as well, to see if that beats this tension propagation, for instance. Is that the sort of thing? I think that's a pretty safe approximation. I don't have a good answer for you off the top of my head. Yeah, but the issue is how fast. I mean, it is diffusion after all, so you should be concerned about how that propagates. Another thing I did leave out also is to look at a faster mode that occurs. Initially, the first thing that happens when you pull on this is you have a sound wave, if you like, sound mode going down the length of the filament. Thermal diffusion, though, that's an interesting.
Heat doesn't necessarily have to diffuse the length of the chain to equilibrate the system. It's sitting in a bath of solvent along its entire length. So
right, but you, but you.
You're not generating heat at all, right? Well, the compression.
Isn't that just the thermal diffusion time of processing all the
liquid?
Yeah.
As I listen to you, I I got the picture that you just assumed that you have a constant temperature at all times in all places. Mm-hmm. So I'm just raising the question whether that is actually going to happen.
Yeah. You could imagine, for instance, there's two parts of this, and I've sort of been jumping back and forth between the two. You can look at the purely passive problem of thermal fluctuations, and then by fluctuation dissipation theorem, those are related to the response, if you were to pull on it. You could imagine yanking on it somehow and worrying about the heat that you would generate in doing that. It's probably safer to think of these passive quantities, the thermal fluctuation.
They're the same problem.
No. There has to be some range where heat conduction enters, but I don't know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just the exchange of heat between the bath and the filament.
Yeah, that's surely it's that matter.
I assume it's extremely hot.
Surely it's there's a lot more solvent than there are in this solvent.
Sure.
Just talking about rather thick filaments, right?
7 nanometers.
No, not compared with length, but there's time needed for a temperature equilibrium within the.
Yeah, but I think.
But I'm just raising this question.
Thermal diffusion time on the scale of nanometers, though, I think it's safely beyond where we're working. I should say that the relevant range for what I'm talking about here is really kilohertz. There's another really big problem that happens as you go to short times. I left out all inertial effects, and on the micron scale, that's going to start appearing at megahertz. For water.
Kilohertz probably is okay.
We need an engineer.
Well, we calculated, estimated the thermal diffusion time for microns.
For a micron bead. Yeah.
So that's over the length of the filaments.
Yeah, it's even less of a problem in the case of a very narrow filament, because of course it's, giving off its energy, it's giving off its heat or coupled to the heat bath very strongly.